The Guardian.
Has everyone got a drink? Yeah. No? Because I think that this sort of thing is much, much easier to take if you're a bit drunk. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chow. Welcome to a very special edition of the show, recorded in front of a live audience and more than a few thousand dead animals. We're at the Natural History Museum in London. We're here to take part in the museum's Science Uncovered event, a time when the curators here throw open the doors for an afternoon and evening of dinosaurs, booze and hands-on science. We thought it'd be a brilliant place to record our podcast and meet some of our listeners. Joining me is a select and august panel to capture and distill tonight's momentous events. Our first two are guests from the museum itself. Dr. Johannes Vogel is Keeper of Botany and Dr. Caroline Smith is Curator of Meteorites. They have pretty good job titles here, don't they? We also have two old friends of the podcast, astrobiologist extraordinaire Zita Martins, who works at Imperial College London and has also been taking part in tonight's Science Uncovered event. And then there's The Guardian's preeminent science blogger, the lay scientist himself, Martin Robbins. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your special Science Weekly panel. Now, you're going to hear the scintillating scientific discussion with our panel in just a moment, but we've not spent this afternoon idly waiting for this recording to start. Oh no. We went cruising through the museum to see what was going down, who was fighting who, which animals had been let out of their basements. So what better way to start the show than with a fight? Our reporter Camilla Ruse went for a ringside seat.
And Chris, our winner tonight, with a massive 26 to 40% increase. No, we're not going to save the giant panda. Big round of applause.
Hi, I'm Chris Lyle. I'm a scientist here in the museum. I'm actually an entomologist. I study beetles for my job.
And what opinion were you just defending?
The opinion that we shouldn't save the giant panda. And I was pushing that by looking at the ecosystem that the panda is in and emphasising that that's the important thing. And also trying to indicate that there are other species which might equally be preserved. And rational decisions are not being made between the panda and other species. We are being blinded by the cuteness of the panda against the reality of it as an organism, as an animal, which can be compared with other animals in terms of their impact on the environment, in terms of the priority we might give them.
And how did the debate go?
Rather surprisingly, I won. I'm pleased at that. I wouldn't entirely follow my own views. The point is that Jeff and I have talked about this before. We're actually in full agreement that we need to preserve the ecosystem, and we use whatever tools we can.
I understand the point. We have to be transparent. I printed off the four
bring
sheets.
Bring away, Jeff. It's not allowed.
No, I said I wouldn't bring a fresh toy.
I
printed this off from the World Wildlife Fund website, and what it actually says is... it's more important than ever to conserve the forest home of the giant panda, not just to safeguard this well-loved species, but to maintain the subsistence fisheries, the agriculture, and the water resources essential.
Hi, I'm Jeff Boxall. I work at the Natural History Museum, and I'm a specialist on marine crustaceans. So tonight I was a bit out of my depth, because I was having to defend the idea that we should save the giant panda from extinction by... setting up nature reserves and so on.
And just tell me, how did the debate go?
Well, I lost the debate, which I was quite surprised about, really, because I always thought the emotional angle would make people vote to save the panda. It's probably good, because the idea of this evening was that we should talk really about the science basis and make rational arguments as to why we should or shouldn't conserve the panda. Chris was obviously more successful in that than I was. Although we both recognise that the giant panda is just a sort of emblem of trying to conserve an entire area of mountain forest that there is in southwest China, my point was that I felt using the giant panda as a flagship to get support and to get money from the public is a good thing, and that you can use it to bring benefits to the whole system. Chris's point was that perhaps we should just try and preserve the system, and the panda was kind of irrelevant to that argument. I hope he's right.
So is that your actual opinion? Were you more on the lines that we shouldn't save the giant panda? Or?
Oh no, I definitely believe we, on a moral basis, we share the planet with a large number of species, and we don't have the right to willingly allow another mammal species to go extinct if we had the chance to save it, which we do. So I was arguing a case I believe in tonight.
That's good. And so do you think it's important to talk about these issues more widely, more in the public eye?
Very much so, because we are going to be faced with difficult choices. I'm afraid my generation of scientists is leaving a world that isn't really fit for business for the next couple of generations.
Reporter Camilla Ruse there showing that consensus is a complex issue when more than one scientist is in the room. Talking of scientists in the room, let's get to our museum specimens on the panel. Johannes, I'm going to start with you. You've been here the longest at the museum. How often do you let everyone just wander around the bowels of the museum? And is it a good thing to do?
The museum is here for the people. The museum is here for everybody to enjoy. This is a collection for the nation. This is a collection for the world. We have about 70 million specimens, plus about 350 scientists, so that makes a few more. We are really exciting to welcome people and show what we do, because the two jobs that we do is doing world-class science and communicating it to the world. And therefore, we are very pleased to be here on this podcast.
One thing that perhaps people who visit the museum and see the dinosaurs and all of that don't know is that there is a huge amount of research going on behind these closed doors.
This is a massive biodiversity and Earth processes and Earth Science Discovery Institute, yes. We are discovering new things all the time, and that's our remit. And we also try to instill in people the idea that this type of diversity and world needs to be preserved and needs to be discovered.
So your job is the Keeper of Botany, which sounds like the most quaint job title I've ever heard. It sounds very sweet. What do? Do you talk to plants and tend them, water them and that sort of thing?
Well, talking to plants works. There was a big experiment at the Royal Horticultural Society a few years ago, and my wife actually did become the voice of Wisley. So her tomatoes grew the best. But no, seriously, I have a few other things to do. So when you run a big science department with about 90 people, obviously you need to work with them and try to make good conditions for this type of science. But also we do all sorts of science that people may not necessarily associate with a museum. So we have state-of-the-art laboratories. We sequence the DNA of organisms. We go out to far-flung places and bring back new specimens, new discoveries. We use latest technologies in optics and digitization to make our discoveries known to the world and freely accessible to the world.
So plants are fascinating.
They are the best, and their sex life is even better.
Okay. Well, I don't know what to do about that. Caroline, your work is a bit more out of this world. How many meteorites do you have in this museum?
Well, we've got just under 5,000 meteorite specimens in the museum. So in some respects, I possibly have one of the easiest jobs because I have the smallest discrete collection to look after of any of my curatorial colleagues. But in terms of its use, it is used massively by scientists here working at the museum. I'm constantly rummaging around in the drawers looking for interesting things to look at myself. Zita here on the panel as well, I give her material to study. So a major part of my job, as Johannes has already mentioned, is actually making this amazing collection that we have here accessible to scientists around England, around the United Kingdom, around Europe, and indeed around the world.
I mean, how old are these rocks that you have in the drawers?
In terms of the actual age of the rocks when they formed, they're the oldest things that we have on Earth. They actually predate the Earth by, depending on when you take the age of the Earth, by between 30 and 150 million years older than the Earth. So they date back to about 4,600 million years old. Some of them we have in terms of age that they've been on Earth. Some of them landed on Earth within the last couple of years, and we've got them in the collection, and others landed on Earth in the 1500s, 1600s.
And what can you do with a meteorite scientifically? I mean, it's nice to have one and think, wow, this is really old, and much older than the Earth. What can you do with that stuff?
How long is a piece of string?
Well, give me one of the things you love doing with meteorites.
Okay, one of the things that I love about meteorites is they're like little time capsules and space probes. one of the things meteorites are often known as is the poor man's space probe. They're the only way that we've got to actually study the geological processes, the physical processes, the chemical processes that were happening in our solar system before the planets formed, when it was very first beginning. And if we can understand those processes better, we can apply that knowledge to astronomical observations of planets forming around stars today, or, you know, light years away. If we know our solar system better, we can apply that knowledge and get a really good handle of our solar system. So it's a good way of sort of doing, it's like astronomy and geology combined. It's a bit of the two.
Now, Zita, using meteorites must be an important part of what you do, which is, I've always thought, to try and find life on other planets. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. As Caroline said, we try to understand, first of all, what's the contribution and why meteorites are so important. In my job, what I do is actually try to analyze and try to see which organic molecules that are the building blocks of life are present in those meteorites, and try to see what was the contribution of meteorites for the origin of life in this planet. First of all, that's the first question. And if life started here on Earth, why not in other places of our solar system, for example, Mars? And so it's trying to understand those two questions, how life originated here on Earth, and the second question is, are we alone in the universe or not? So that's the line.
Do you think we are alone in the universe?
I don't know. I mean, if you've seen the film Contact, they say it would be a waste of space. And I agree with that. It would be a waste of space if we were the only ones.
But that's it would be a waste of space if there was a purpose for that space.
I don't know. But if thinking about it from the chemistry point of view, you know, if things started here on Earth and the conditions were the correct ones, we have the right conditions in other places of our solar system and in other places of our universe. So why wouldn't we have life starting in other places?
So what's the most tantalizing thing in the work that in your field that sort of led you to think, you know what, this is actually going towards answering the question in some way? What's the most tantalizing thing that's happened?
I think the future missions to Mars, the life detection missions, and try to see if there was ever life on Mars, and if in fact there was, did we have the same genesis or not, or is it from a completely different branch of life? So that would be really interesting to see if there was life on Mars and it was completely different or not. I mean, so trying to answer all that. It's also trying to understand who we are here on Earth, and how we appear here, actually.
Johannes, you touched right at the end there in your talk about the sex life of plants. And plants, just to sort of say, when we look for life out there in other planets, we're sometimes thinking they're going to be just like ours. But the diversity of plants out there might suggest that there could be all sorts of things that we might never be able to detect. I mean, does your work specifically help any of these other things that we've talked about? Or can we talk about the sex life of plants instead? Just do that.
Well, it's too late in the evening, I think, to talk about sex. But
I think it's not at all.
But I think botany is not necessarily the best discipline to help the big questions of origins of life and genesis of life.
Could we be looking for chlorophyll and that sort of thing?
Well, there are various forms how you can generate energy from the environment. Photosynthesis is only one. I mean, the bacteria and the protists, they have prokaryotes. They have much, much more diverse forms of existence than plants or any higher animal is. The big things that we normally collect in museums, the plants, the animals, the insects, everything that is visible to the naked eye, they are really only the tip of the tree of life. All the diversity is all at the bottom, and that is where one should hunt for different life forms. And for example, there is a debate going on that because we are focusing so much on the type of life that we know, we may not really observe other forms of life that it coexist with us, but we have not tuned into discovering this type of life. So there are bigger questions than botany, I have to admit.
Martin, let's bring you in here. You've not been to the museum for a couple of decades, which is shocking for a fan of science.
I know.
What have you been looking around at this afternoon?
Well, yeah, I mean, the last time I came here, I was about your height. And
so that was last week.
So, my main sort of difference since then is that everything's a lot smaller. But it's nice. I mean, the The kind of natural, the bird sections are very nice. The dinosaur exhibits I was less keen on, to be honest, because they're full of children absolutely everywhere, so you're just constantly stepping on kids and crying and all this kind of stuff going on. And with the birds, there's some really fantastic sort of exhibits there with and displays and drawings and kind of, you know, stuffed animals and so on. Where with the dinosaurs, there's all this kind of animatronic stuff, which is just a bit too newfangled for me.
But it makes it more lively and scary and terrifying.
It's not really, it doesn't sort of turn me on, the kind of animatronic dinosaur thing. I'm more interested in stuffed animals.
All right.
Not in that sense, but I don't know, it's just a bit... I think it's a bit over the top.
That's a very, very important point that is made here. The museum is there because we have objects. And these real objects, not the animatronic stuff, the real stuff actually allows the visitor to come up with their own interpretation of the world. And that is what is important. We are here a place to challenge thought and challenge thinking and also give people a sense of themselves and the world. And that is best done through real objects. That is the whole purpose of a museum and not any fancy gadgets. It sounds a bit old-fashioned, but I think it is very important to make that point.
Caroline?
Well, actually, Johannes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things, I've been involved in a few exhibitions in the last few years, and one of the things that the museum is very much going to, and I completely think is the right way, as Johannes says, is going to specimen-rich exhibitions. So we don't want to see, you know, animatronic dinosaurs. They have their place, and we don't want to see interactive media screens. You want to see things on display. We are not the National Museum of Dinosaurs and Other Stuff. We are the National Collection of Natural History Objects. Johannes has already said we have 70 million plus specimens in our collection, and we must get those on display. Possibly not all 70 million, but we certainly need to get those on display, give the narrative, tell why these objects are so wonderful, and let everybody, our 4.7 million visitors a year, see those, the wonderful things that we get to work on every day.
I suppose, is this the thinking behind the Darwin Centre, where you have everything in pickle jars out in all their gory glory?
Yes, it's very important. The Darwin Centre has two purposes. One, to put more of our specimens on display, but also show the work that the scientists do and explain the process of science itself. And that is a very important thing, again, for an organisation like this. We need scientifically literate citizens in this country to maintain a sort of democracy. And science and technology poses really, really big questions to the future of the planet and to the future of humanities. And people need to understand a bit about the process of science to be part of the democratic decision-making in relation to our joint future. And the museum has a big, big... A big challenge here at its hands. We are reaching 4.7 million people through our doors, 10, 11 million unique identified web visitors. So there's lots of people who come here to find type of answers, and that is what we need to provide.
I completely agree with you, obviously, because you agreed with me. But I think it's the real exhibits that are much more engaging. I mean, it was quite galling to get to the end of, say, the dinosaurs and find this space practically the size of this theatre given over to this big dancing animatronic, you know, T-Rex thing. Whereas the exhibits that really drew me in and made me stop and look and think were things where, you know, fossils where you had to kind of try and work out what bit was when. And for example... there was a fantastic exhibit with the kind of mosaic of bird specimens just in the thing, where you sort of stopped and looked at the diversity and the kind of evolution, and it really drew you in and made you stop and look at it instead of kind of thrusting this thing upon you.
Okay, well, we'll leave that discussion there. Let's see what else has been going on tonight in the rest of the museum. How about a peek into the lives of some of the museum's unsung heroes, the conservation unit?
I've just come to the basement of the Natural History Museum to see a very special set of people. This lab is particularly important to nearly all the departments here, and we're just going to go and have a look. Hello, can you tell us who you are?
I'm Jill Comerford, and this is the Paleontology Conservation Unit.
And so what do you do here? It sounds probably obvious from the title, and you've got the big orange sticker on your lab coat to say PCU, but tell us the type of things you get up to.
Well, this lab serves the paleontology department particularly, and we do paleontology replication and mainly conservation. So the department has 9 million specimens in its drawers and cupboards upstairs and downstairs and all the way around us. And when the objects are maybe deteriorating, have an issue, have a problem, or maybe they're going to go on display, then people come to us and ask us to fix them, repair them, put them in a mount, all sorts of things that might need to be done for them.
So can you show us something that's sort of being repaired at the moment? I can see all sorts of fossils and epoxy resin and things in vats and cupboards. What's an interesting thing that's being repaired?
This is the humerus of a dinosaur, Chasmosaurus, and it came down here because one of our researchers took it out of the cupboard to have it photographed for her research, and it came apart in her hands, as she said.
So this is a 3-foot-long, brown, sort of very broad bone. It looks like a bone, and it came apart in her hands. It looks very heavy.
It looks very heavy, and actually I think possibly she could have asked us to help her get it out of the cupboard, but say no more.
So you repair bones. What else do you look after?
Well, one of the things that I do is I run the site-wide monitoring system, and we have over 450 transmitters on that system, and they measure relative humidity, temperature and light, and that data is really important for us to understand what is happening in our collections. So we keep them in our collections areas, inside the cabinets, outside the cabinets, in the galleries and inside the gallery cases. And we not only do this in South Kensington, but we do this at our South London store and also at our museum in Tring, and we collect all this data into a huge database, and all of the people who have access to the system can see what's happening to their specimens, even though they might be located quite a distance from their specimens. And it's very useful because when the system goes outside of our specified parameters, we will then contact our engineers, and they will try where they can. It's not always possible, but where they can, they will try and put things, you know, right again for us.
What kinds of things actually damage your specimens then in the museums?
Well, high humidity can exacerbate catalyse, in fact, pyrite decay. And pyrite decay is when iron pyrite is within a specimen starts to oxidise, and the products from the oxidisation can also destroy the labels and destroy the information that goes with the specimen.
Now, it looks like in this workshop there's lots of arts and crafts going on. I mean, these are very valuable specimens, but what are the materials you're using? And are these things that someone who's building models and things would recognise?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because we use an awful lot of card. We make bespoke boxes and for our objects, and then we use foam within those boxes to make sure that the specimens don't rattle around in their boxes, because what we try to do is prevent objects from damage, and we call this preventive conservation, and a lot of our energy is spent on preventive conservation. And anybody who comes to our department as a volunteer, even if they don't come to our lab, is taught box making. Box making is really important, because if you just buy boxes off the shelf, then you don't necessarily get the right size. And size is also important, because we can't keep enlarging the size of our stores, so we need the size of our boxes to be correct. It might sound really, really trivial, but it actually is very important to us not to have to keep building new stores. So we have to make sure we have bespoke containers for our objects, and it is very time consuming.
Jill Comerford there, of the Natural History Museum's Conservation Unit. Caroline, Johannes, how important are these guys to what you do?
Well, I work a lot with the Paleo Conservation Unit. They're called the Paleo Conservation Unit, the Paleontology Conservation Unit, but actually they provide a service to all of the science departments at the museum. And they're absolutely wonderful. They're world leaders in their field, and looking after meteorites, which, because they are naturally happy in space, they're not naturally happy on the ground. I have to do a lot of work with them. So we've designed special cases that have got nitrogen atmospheres and are very dry and things like that to help preserve the meteorites. Because at the end of the day, these are precious objects that we want to preserve. So people like Zeta, when she does her analyses, knows that she's getting good data from that rock and not contamination or terrestrial alteration or anything like that. So they provide a priceless, actually, service to the organisation.
Well, give you an idea of what we are looking at. It's not just that we have all these things coming in from outer space. We have all this stuff that humans collected in the last 400-500 years. So at the heart of the museum are the collections of Hans Sloan, who, as a private benefactor, donated his collections to the nation, asked them to build a museum, the origin of the British Museum, and thus the Natural History Museum, and his collections are here. And they were kept in a secure room under climate-controlled condition, and then needed to move into this new Darwin Center here. But in this Darwin Center, everything that comes in here has to be pest-free because these little insects gnaw away at all our lovely collections. But these books are from the 16th, 17th, 18th century. And you can't just throw them in the freezer like the rest of the stuff because these books are held together by special glue. So we needed to have experts to find out what conditions can actually be used in order to kill the insects but not destroy the books. And that is the type of conservation work that we need, and that's unique knowledge that needs to be held here. So we do not just only need to know what life on Earth there is or elsewhere in the universe. We not only need to know how to look after our visitors or look after our own staff, we also need to know a lot more technical details. It's a very diverse organisation, fantastic to work in, and I think it's doing a great job.
So handing your CVs at the door if you're interested in jobs. Let's move on to some recent news stories. I asked our panellists to come armed with things they've seen in the last few weeks in the news. So we're going to start with Martin. You're going to talk about neutrinos.
Yes.
What? There was a murmur in the crowd because they know you're going to be angry. They know it. They know it already.
Well, this is a completely uncontroversial finding that's emerged it's still kind of breaking as well.
What was the name of the lab?
As we're sitting, it's the Toro Rosso. It's the Gran Sasso lab in Italy, which has been picking up, detecting streams of neutrinos coming from the CERN facility in Geneva, about 500 miles away. And what they've found, or what they claim to have found, is that some of the neutrinos coming from that facility that they're detecting have gotten there faster than the speed of light, essentially, by about 90 nanoseconds. I forget the exact figure. Alok probably knows
60 billionths of a nanosecond.
60 billionths of a nanosecond.
60 billionths of a second, or something
60
like
billionths
that.
Of a second. That's quite a big difference.
Yeah, well, okay. It's faster.
That's a billion times difference. But yeah.
It's written somewhere.
We read the articles that we've got on guardian.co.uk/science, and those will tell you exactly how many nanoseconds.
You don't need to know the facts to discuss this.
Or science it is. No, we don't, which is good.
So
essentially, this has already kind of caused a bit of scepticism to break out among physicists online. Jim Al-Khalili has already promised that he's going to eat his pants live on TV if the discovery turns out to be true. And Newsnight have actually picked him up on that tonight as well. So fingers crossed it'll come to bear.
Let's get to the heart of this, which is that this is a result that came out after 15,000 measurements of various speeds of neutrinos at the Gran Sasso laboratory. And what the scientists have done is to say, look, we've found this anomalous result. It seems to break the laws of special relativity and the speed of light and all of this. So anyone want to find some holes in this?
Well, the problem basically is that, Carl Sagan always said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And what they've done is it's almost like if I went up to the top of Dippy the Diplodocus and dropped a cannonball off and came out and said, oh, yes, it's dropped down and it's hit the ground before I actually recorded it going off. It would be a pretty amazing claim if it were true and defy all of the known laws of physics. Well, not all of the known laws of physics, sorry. It's a slight exaggeration. We can edit that little bit out where I said all of the known laws of physics. It would defy the laws of physics as we currently know them. And so it would be a pretty big deal, overturn you know, nearly a century of what we've previously established. But the evidence that they've supplied for this is pretty sketchy. There's a paper which has not been through peer review or proper publication yet. It wasn't even available when the Reuters press release broke at the end of yesterday and when the original news stories went up. So nobody's in the communities really had a chance to cross-check these results. And the lab involved, the Gran Sasso lab, has a slight history of similar claims in the past. In 2000, they claimed to have discovered dark matter and detected it. And since then, those claims didn't really come to much at all, and so the suspicion is that they've jumped the gun a bit here and that it's going to turn out to be a bit of a damp squib.
Let's talk to our three scientists on the panel now. This is a fairly standard thing you have to do with scientific results. When you get something controversial, you publish it, it gets peer reviewed, and then someone tries to replicate it. In this case, as Martin said, the data has been published, it's not been peer reviewed yet, and the idea is that it will be replicated and peer reviewed subsequently. But this is fairly standard in physics. This is what physicists do. Do any of you sort of have a problem with this, or do you share Martin's scepticism on it?
Well, Yes, I mean, I would be very skeptical about this type of stuff. But for normal science, not perhaps physics.
I'm gonna come back to you on that.
The peer review process is the gold standard, and I think it's fairly important that this is upheld. We do science as a public pursuit, and yes, we are constantly critiqued and challenged by our peers, and that is the only way to progress in this issue. And one has to go fairly and squarely about it, and just going for cheap publicity or something like that is really not the aim of science. You can become a politician if you want to do that.
Zita, Caroline, do you have any thoughts that are maybe positive about this story? Who are you more annoyed with? Are you annoyed with the journalists who reported it or the scientists who reported it?
I think it's a combination of the two, actually. I'm equally annoyed with both of them. I think it's...
See what I mean? What did I say?
I'm not angry at everyone. It's just but those two groups of people that happen to represent quite a large chunk of science. It's a sort of disturbing, growing trend where, as the relationship between journals and scientists and the media gets more and more incestuous, it's become quite easy for scientists in certain institutions or groups or in certain positions in public life to just get their theories into the media with, you know, circumventing the scientific community. And sometimes it's good to get ideas out there and discuss them openly, but if it's something this big, then I think you've got a responsibility to make sure that you don't start, you know, miseducating the public or undermining their confidence.
It's the public, actually, because if you have a big story like this without having a peer review, the public actually doesn't know if it's true or not, and it creates this big, big mess. So basically the process should be, you have results, then it's peer reviewed, so your colleagues evaluate, say yes or no, try to prove it or disprove the results, and then when the article is published, you can finally have the media saying, okay, this is a big story, let's go for it, and not starting inventing stuff, because, I mean, this case of the neutrinos may be and actually a really nice story that changes physics and everything. We don't know yet, but we're still not sure. The article needs to be peer-reviewed.
I completely agree with Zita, and one of the issues that we have certainly within the UK funding situation is quite rightly the research councils are very, very keen that we publicise our science and our work and what we do. However, there is a fine line to tread between making sure our good work is publicised and making sure maybe the nearly work, not quite their work, we're not sure work is publicised, but people know that it's first thing. So it's a multi-edged sword, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because otherwise it's going to be like the boy that cried wolf. I mean, exactly. It's going to be a really bad situation, and at some point the public is not going to believe in scientists anymore.
No, it's going to trust everything we say.
Exactly. I mean,
which is wrong, because...
Just to defend physics here, by the way. All of you, all you guys. I have to say, the one thing that to defend this particular thing, this is how they talk to each other on various blogs and websites, and they're very open about their data, they're very open about their science, and they put all their papers pre-publication on archive, by the way, which is another thing you can talk about open science. And this is before peer review. They didn't claim it was peer reviewed, but this is how it's going to be peer reviewed. So in a sense, you're right, the gold standard is there, but this is how these guys have always done it, and they've made it quite clear, I think, in that respect. Let's move on, though, to two actual some peer-reviewed science. Zita, this planet that looks like Tatooine from Star Wars.
Yes, so basically we had this news that the Kepler Space Telescope discovered this planet called Kepler-16b. And the interesting thing is that it's a planet that orbits a binary star system. So just like, you know, Star Wars movie, it's just so you have more information. The planet is the size of Saturn. It's very cold. It's basically composed of gas and rock. So from the life, possibility of life in there, there's not too much possibility of having life. But this was on the news because of basically of, you know, you have the science fiction first, you have Star Wars, you have other novels like the novel by Isaac Asimov, Nightfall, that also was describing, you know, a planet orbiting several suns. And then later on, science really proves that, you know, what science fiction already published. So it's I always give the example of so of Jules Verne's when he wrote in 1865, Going to the Moon. And 100 years later, then NASA has the Apollo program and we actually go to the moon. And lots of things actually on that romance were like exactly the same as in actually the Apollo 11 mission. So that was amazing. It's like, okay, science and science fiction walking side by side. And sometimes science really, you know, ends up proving what science fiction already wrote. So it's, I think it all starts with creativity and imagination. So I think it's also important for the audience to see that scientists are creative people and it all starts with a problem and the scientists have to be creative to try to solve that problem.
Can I ask the rest of the panel, did any of you get into science or get interested because of science fiction?
Yes, definitely. Well, science fiction and kind of stories about exploration as well growing up. And so I always had quite a keen interest in like wildlife and the natural world and traveling and exploration and science. And that's just carried through to today. Failed as a sort of academic and wrote about stuff and criticised other people instead, and that seems to be working.
Why did you do academic with jazz hands? are you assuming they've got some sort of amazing
That was
life?
Just an unconscious twinge that I get just, now when I think about my time in academia.
There it was again. I've got witnesses. Quickly, we'll do one more story. Johannes, let's talk about botany and the fact that only a very small number of the world's species are actually described. Tell us about this.
Yes, there have been quite a number of stories lately on how little we actually know about life on Earth. And that is also perhaps why I slate physics, because I'm just jealous that they get all the billions that botany needs. So, but let's underpin this with facts. So very often we get asked, why do you have 70 million specimens here? Is it really necessary to have these many? Do you still need to collect? Blah, 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 blah. So we had two papers lately, one in the public Library of Science and one in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. So the PLOS paper stated that they've done some calculations and they found out that between 84 to 90% of all life on Earth still needs to be discovered. Now imagine, in institutions like this, all over the world, you have hundreds and hundreds of taxonomists and systematists working day and night, when they're not talking to the Guardian, trying to discover life on Earth. And they've done this now for 250 years, and they came up with 10% of life discovered. So that is pretty poor. And at the same time, we have the sixth extinction crisis. We are losing life on Earth faster than we discover it. So this is a really, really big issue. And the money that is spent on CERN would actually solve this issue.
Wait a minute.
So, but now, there's a second story, and fortunately, a number of people from my department were involved in this, and this is that they discovered for flowering plants, at least, and it may be true for lots of other organisms as well, most of the stuff that needs to be discovered to get a complete picture on life on Earth is actually already in this building, just above you, just 20 meters above you, are our plant collections. And there's a bit of concrete in between, don't worry. So these 65% of all the plants that still need to be discovered on Earth are already collected and in the herbaria.
It
so that is another plea for more jobs in this building and more money spent on botany. So the issue is there's a massive challenge out there, a global challenge. In my opinion, as much as I would love to know what life on Mars is, I wouldn't want to spend the billions on it until I actually know what life on Earth is, because that is where we live and that is the life that sustains us, that sustains the ecosystems, that gives us clean water, clean air, and a bit of food thrown in. If you want drugs, you can get them from there as well. So everything you need, you get on Earth. But please, 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 let's all get together and find out what we actually have here. And one of the challenges is then for institutions like the Natural History Museum to galvanize their forces, be smart, use modern technology, and get on with the job.
So last time you talked to me about this, Johannes, you had me hugging elm trees in South Downs. I'm not sure
look what it's done to you.
Look what it's done to me, exactly. I still love physics, though. No, but in all seriousness, Zita, Caroline, I mean, the work you do is the stuff that gets people into science in a way, you know, astrobiology, meteorites, you know, we all love that stuff. But do you agree with Johannes that we need to know much more about the world around us? We just don't know enough?
We need to know more about the world around us, but we also need to know what's around us in the solar system and in the universe. It's all around us. It doesn't need to be here on the Earth. I always get this question of people saying, oh, you spend so much money in space missions. Why, oh, why? Well, the thing that people have to see is there's lots of spin-offs. And also the space industry contributes a lot to the economy, to increase the quality of life of people. It creates more jobs and all the technology we're developing for space missions. It's day-to-day basis. If you have cleaner water and lots of things. I mean, technology is so important. And so,
very, very good point. But the latest story done by economists and the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment clearly show that ecosystem services carried out by this life on Earth contribute more value to society than the combined global GDP. So the few hundreds of jobs and innovations that space technology apparently brings are really insignificant in relation to the ecosystem services that supply you with the really basic needs. Yes, you may want a Teflon-coated frying pan for your eggs in the morning, but you need the chicken first to have the eggs.
All right, okay. Before this explodes, do you want to say something really quick?
Well, yeah, just very quickly, I think, you know, it's sad to have two different disciplines of science, you know, fighting each other for funding. They should both have as much as they need because God knows we waste enough elsewhere. So, you know, I'm all for everyone getting funding.
All right, well,
One point I would just very quickly like to make is that it's, you know, meteorites can come out of space and kill us. I've never seen a plant falling out of the sky. So, you know, I wouldn't want to completely drop that.
Trees sort of fall over us.
Poison you.
All right. Okay. Well, I just like to say that plants and things are beautiful, of course, but so are quarks and gluons. I mean, they're all beautiful. You can read more about neutrinos, exoplanets, plants, all that stuff at guardian.co.uk/science. You're listening to a special edition of Science Weekly recorded live in front of a select audience at the Natural History Museum in London. One of the benefits of recording in front of a live audience is that we can tap into their knowledge and opinions right away. So we're going to go to you now for questions. So tell us who you are and what your question is. Wait for the microphone first. And the first question should go to Caroline because she has to go fairly soon to actually do some real work. To real work. So ask her your questions first. Go for it. Tell us who you are and what your question is.
Hi, I'm Kate Jones. I work at the Zoological Society of London. My question is about the exhibits that you were bringing up before. So I noticed that some of the exhibits are slightly out of date, especially the mammals. So I guess the question is, what are the challenges of trying to keep up to date with the science and to involve the public in that? And that must be quite tricky.
All right, that's Kate Jones, a mammal expert from the Zoological Society of London, by the way.
Thank you, Kate. That's a brilliant question. And obviously, being on a podcast, you can't see, but this is the problem. Money is the problem. We are constantly battling for funds within the museum for our public engagement program. You know, you can imagine there's capital equipment purchases, there's this. There's always a constant battle for money, as I'm sure it is at the zoo as well. In terms of how do we decide which exhibits are going to be done, there's a program. It's the Permanent Board, whatever it's called, and they, you know, these are very, very senior staff within the museum, from the science departments, from our public engagement departments as well. They look at various things. They look at funding opportunities from charities or donors or other areas to decide what is going to be done. But I think certainly within the museum, I don't think I'm committing a heresy. I think we know that there are areas of our museum that need updating drastically, just in terms of the content, in terms of the modern science, let's say. And it is a rolling programme of updates that we are doing, but it comes down, at the end of the day, to money, because we're trying to do we're trying to be jacks of all trades. We're trying to continue being a world-leading science institution and basically a fun park museum, you know, and a business. So we've got three sort of disparate areas that we're trying to combine. It's not easy. We're doing our best, and we have some very, very good people working on these problems.
And we do have very exciting plans for a new biodiversity exhibition. So that is all in order. We are aware of our weaknesses, but as in life, you better play to your strengths than constantly trying to play on your weaknesses. So it is in hand. We are going about it, but we needed to build the Darwin Center first. That's done. Now let's move on to the next, and eventually we will come to mammals.
Okay, more questions. More questions.
Hi, my name's Rosser. I'm doing a study at the moment in lung function and pollution in children. That's made me stop using my bicycle so much. And I'm just wondering, what bit of your research should affect my behaviour the most?
What bit of your research should affect his behaviour the most? His specifically. Anyone?
We're all going to die of space germs or impacts. There you go.
Avoid those.
Yeah.
Well, I think the efforts that we undertake to conserve life on Earth and the functions of the ecosystem, that will ultimately, if we succeed with that, then you are safe. If we don't, it will certainly impact on your life. Believe me that. And okay. Cycling won't be the problem.
I mean, the stuff I do in industry is around water distribution networks and stuff, and I do some research into that at the moment. My advice to you would basically be panic.
Right, more questions?
I'm a physics teacher in an inner city London school, and I was just wondering, it's just that they came into class today and they were really excited to hear about this thing about neutrinos and the speed of light, and is it not a good idea for them to come in excited about a class, even if it's not been peer-reviewed, just to be like, to start a discussion, and we're doing a really boring lesson, but we could actually discuss something interesting and to get them into it? Because I remember when I was at school, physics had come in, and even though I'm a physics teacher, I could groan a lot of the time when I came into lessons, but they were really excited.
But I think that's actually the goal of science. And as Caroline said before, we need to do a lot of public outreach, and that's why we're also here. I do lots of public outreach, and for me, I'm very happy when I go to a high school and the kids say, oh, this is so exciting. And so I understand from that point of view, it's very important that the media communicate and say, okay, we had this science story and not just stories about Hollywood or whatever. For us, it's very, very important that science is communicating and trying to explain what we do in the labs and try to show that to the public. So in that sense, it's extremely important. But for us scientists, there has to be a control of quality, because otherwise this doesn't make sense. Otherwise we're not scientists anymore, you know? We're just actors here pretending to be something else.
Martin, I mean, on that quality issue, I was going to come to you. It's not just scientists who maintain quality. I mean, there's a whole sphere of bloggers and things who do the same thing and increasingly are doing the same thing and engaging in conversations which are important and interesting for everyone from teachers to scientists to take note of.
Well, absolutely. I think actually you could look at this as a very good teaching opportunity, because you can look at the kind of response from especially the professional physicists who are bloggers. There's no professional physics bloggers. They don't make any money. But there's a really, really good opportunity to look at how results come out to the public, look at the role of peer review in journals, look at disputes within science, and look at how something might have weaknesses and other physicists will challenge it, and really give them an opportunity to see that science, because there's so much of science reporting which is just, oh, we've published a paper and the media just presents it as this paper is scientific fact and this contradictory one is also scientific fact and there you go. And this kind of does at least give you an insight into the underlying tensions and conflicts and arguments in science, which are what drive science. I mean, science is one big argument, basically. And whoever's alive at the end, their theories accept it. And maybe not quite like that, but it's. I think it's a fantastic teaching opportunity. I really do.
Martin, I would absolutely like to pick up on that. I mean, I think this whole thing is actually a perfect opportunity for science teachers in schools and also people who set the national curriculum to use these sorts of examples of controversial science where scientists are not agreeing, well, these scientists say that's not peer-reviewed, but these scientists say that's how they do it. You know, this is exactly how you can engage young people, is to say, look, scientists don't know everything. That's why they're scientists. They're trying to find out. They argue sometimes. They have pops at conferences sometimes. We've
yeah,
seen
we
it.
Yeah, we know about that.
We know about that. You know, and
Jim Alcalides going to eat his pants on live TV.
But this is the important thing. You know, I mean, it's to understand that, you know, one of our brand values at the museum is, you know, the voice of authority on the natural world. You know, but we are not always right, and there's nothing wrong with that, and to acknowledge that you're not always right, that's how science works. And if young people can understand that, Johannes mentioned it earlier, that's the basis of a literate, intelligent community population who can understand different things, economy, medicine, da da da. That's what we need in this country, is a scientific and technical and engineering literate society.
Question in the middle.
My name is Gilad Amit, and to set a bit of a theme, I'm a recent physics graduate. It's a quick question for Caroline and possibly for Johannes as well. Among the items you have in your collection, you mentioned, Caroline, about meteorites 400 or 500 years old, on Earth 400 or 500 years. What's the most interesting story behind an individual item in your collection?
Wow.
Well, the story that I like to recall is slightly odd but highly topical today. So, there was a man, a hydrogeologist called Aronson, who was sent out by the Zionist Congress to use his knowledge of hydrology and botanical diversity to see what the water situation in the Near East is. And he used this knowledge, and his collections are in this building, just above you, to draw a map of the state of Israel in order to maximize the water use by this to be emerging state. And water has ever since, and as shown in the UN today, been a big source of the conflict in that area. So that is probably the most topical and political discussion. And with water becoming such a sparse resource, for example, especially in the Himalayan region, where the water of the Himalayas supports more than 50% of the world's population, but the water is controlled mainly by one state, China. We will see more of these issues emerging, and plants and water are ultimately intimately linked. So watch out for this one.
Well, I've got a water-related question as well. It's a bit of a joke in the planetary science community, with much respect to my colleagues at NASA, about, so what would you say, Zita, once or twice a year NASA announced they found water on Mars?
Yes. Yeah. Well, or right on the moon.
Boring. Yeah. Here we go again. Are you at Congress looking for more money again? Money. and a specimen that's very, very close to my heart, in fact, is one of my favourite specimens in the museum, and you can actually see a piece of it at my Nature Live, which I have to go off and do imminently, or my colleagues have got a piece of it on the space station, is the piece of a meteorite called Narkla, which fell in Egypt in 1911, 28th of June 1911. It's just had its 100th birthday on Earth, and it's one of the about 100 meteorites that we have from Mars. And why that is particularly dear to my heart is a former colleague of mine, who sadly died a few years ago, a guy called Robert Hutchison, studied that meteorite in the 1970s. And he was the first person to find that it had minerals in it that had to be formed through the action of liquid water. And he was able to prove that this had to be on the parent body, so where the meteorite originally came from. Didn't happen on Earth, it wasn't terrestrial alteration. And then lo and behold, it turned out that these meteorites were from Mars. So Bob is actually the first person to have actually found evidence of liquid water on Mars. So every time NASA announces, yawn, boring, here we go again. We knew that at the Natural History Museum in the 1970s.
There is water on Mars, let's just say there is,
there
shall
is,
we?
Absolutely.
No more need to actually announce this all over again. So some more questions, please. Something at the front. How about here?
Hello, I'm Liz from the Pod Delusion podcast. Aside from giving the Natural History Museum our cold hard cash, what's the best way we can support museums and natural history collections?
What's the best way we can support museums and natural history collections?
Well, two things. First of all, visit us. Visit any museum that has natural history collections and get involved. do it yourself. You were born as an observer. David Attenborough was once asked by a journalist, "So, Sir David, when did you discover your love of nature?" And apparently his reply was, "When did you lose yours?" So the thing is, we are born as observers. Look at children. They run around, they pick things up, they examine them. And somehow culture overforms us slightly, and we think that we don't need to become natural historians. Well, good, more jobs for us. But nevertheless, with the internet and, for example, with places like the Angela Marmont Center, just 20 meters from where we are sitting here, you can actually get involved and you can rekindle your love with nature. And that is one of the biggest services you can do, not just to natural history museums, but also actually to yourself.
Well, we'll leave that there. I want to ask Johannes one final thing before we finish, which is that, Johannes, you've been at this museum for years and years and years, but in a few months you're going to be somewhere else. Tell us where you're going to be.
Yes, well, I'm going to be in Berlin. Never thought I would go back to Germany, but they needed a director for the Natural History Museum there, and I'm fortunate enough to take it on.
Now, this is an amazingly interesting challenge, because we went to Berlin, we went to this museum several months ago. We spoke to Matthias Glaubrecht there, head of science and mollusks at the museum. He showed me around endless empty rooms where they want to build things. I mean, this must be the most exciting job in museums at the moment.
It's pretty exciting, yes. I'm really looking forward to it. Berlin has a very interesting slogan: "We are very poor but sexy." So I think I'm coming from the right place to to spread the seeds there. It's a great place. They have a very exciting building program going, and it's a town that is really vibrant and wants to go places. So this museum has been a fantastic place to work. It's given me great pleasure, lots of friends, and lots of experiences. And now I'm quite happy to put it to use in a different place. But I'm not going to stop reading The Guardian.
Once again, the Germans learning from the English there. That's brilliant. We like that. And can we just say, when you've developed...
Can I say it in German?
Do.
Von England lebt... Von England lernen, yes. Von England lernen heißt Siegen lernen, yes.
Ah, sehr gut. So listen, when you do rebuild the museum and everything's amazing, we'll come back. And can you let all of our audience in for free as well?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, well, yeah. Good. And the beer is better there.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's... Undoubtedly, that's true. All right, well, I think we'll have to leave this podcast there. Thank you so much to our panel, Johannes, Caroline, Zita and Martin, and also to our roving reporter, Camilo Ruiz. Remember to head over to guardian.co.uk/science to keep up to speed with breaking news at any time. That's science news, by the way. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producers Scott Cawley and Jason Phipps, and sound engineer Ben Cape, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.